Welcome to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show on, I think it's September 5th already, if you can believe that. I don't know how that started, but anyhow, today's guest is Dave Bloom, and we, of course, we've been advertising the show for the last week. He has my special interest in the alternative fuel sources, like make your fuel at home. Dave started his ecological training at a young age. He has, in his father, organically grew almost all the food their family ate. And I noticed Dave's eyes are very clear. This wouldn't be unusual in a rural setting nowadays, but they did this in a hot city in San Francisco in the mid-60s. And he was employed by NASA to work on an experimental solar self-energy, a self-sufficient energy sewage treatment system, desalinization plant in the Virgin Islands, and on and on and on. I'll let him explain his background. I guess we both worked at NASA. David, are you there?
I'm here, Dr. Fred.
How's it going, man?
Well, it's going great.
Have I ever met you? Your name sounded so familiar.
Yeah, it seems like we must have run into each other somewhere.
Yeah. So anyway, before we jump on the main topic, would you, I started to read your background. Could you do some highlights on your background so people can understand how you got into this cool field that everybody needs to know about?
Well, those of us with gray hair probably remember Mother Earth News back in the day, back in the mid-70s, and I was one of the main researchers at that think tank back then, where we did a lot of appropriate tech development and published a lot of plans for devices that people could build themselves that either were energy-related or oriented toward efficient use of land and that kind of thing. And, of course, I'm an ecological biologist and a biosystematist, which nowadays I use that in what I do in what's called permaculture, which is a ecological land design system, and I consult for individuals and for governments on land issues as well as energy issues. And I guess what's going on nowadays is my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, has been out for a few months now, and
how's that book doing? It's a great. I love your cover, by the way.
Well, thanks
great
a lot.
Cover.
Well, this last month we got over 2 million hits on our website, so I'd say we're probably finally getting some attention here.
Yeah, you're getting some attention now. So
well,
you've been getting hits the last week.
Oh well, of course. You know what's going on. Of course, is a couple of things. The price of gas has been up for the last few months. Right now it's down, which is, it's strictly an artifact of the upcoming election. Doesn't have any other reason for it to be happening. But a lot of people have begun to figure out that although they're kind of going back to sleep saying, oh, 350 gallon, it's the good old days, gas is cheap. Well, these people haven't been paying for fuel oil since last winter. And so, they're about to find out that to heat their home this winter is going to cost them three times as much as it did last winter.
Wow.
By the time they start buying fuel oil. So a lot of people who are calling and are interested in alcohol fuel at this point are interested in more than just their car. They're talking about how are they going to heat their home or make electricity, any number of things that people can do with alcohol that replace the non-renewable ways we do things now.
So when did you start getting into making ethanol? Ethanol, per se.
Well, I was back in the 70s. One of my ecology professors was on his last year there, so he didn't have to care what anyone thought. So he used to, with a straight face, lie to us and see if we'd catch him. And, well, one day he said this bottle of fermenting yeast on the counter would run your car. And I pointed to him and I said, gotcha, you're lying to us. And he was a good teacher, so he said, prove it. So I went to the library. Man, I discovered this whole history of alcohol fuel that I never knew existed, no one I knew existed, that, basically it was the first auto fuel before gasoline was ever invented and was the best auto fuel all through the history of automobiles and had this incredible political history that, no one had clued me into, at that point in my life. So I got very hooked by the kind of the secret history aspect of alcohol. Most people would be surprised to learn that the Model T, one of the first production automobiles, was designed right from the start to be a dual-fuel alcohol-gasoline vehicle. And that basically gasoline was very uncommon except in cities, and if people were out of the city at all, they had to stop by a farm to tank up on alcohol because basically every farm had a still. It was a standard piece of equipment. So, you know, the Model A was a good example of the flexible fuel vehicles that we have nowadays. It had two different things that had to be adjusted for alcohol. One was the air-fuel mixture, how much air you mixed with the fuel you were burning. Alcohol needs a lot less oxygen than gasoline does because it's got some built into its chemical structure. So there was a knob on the dashboard of the Model T that went to a long rod down to the carburetor, and you could actually adjust the carburetor from inside the car. Carburetor, of course, is something we don't have in cars anymore, but it used to be the part that determined the mixture of air and fuel. And then the other thing the Model T had was a digital distributor. A distributor is the thing that sends spark to each of the spark plugs. And what made it digital was it took the five digits on your left hand and moved the lever up and down to advance the spark or determine when the spark fired. And you started the spark a lot earlier for alcohol than you did for gasoline.
Right. All people got their arms broke cranking their cars before they had electric starters.
Yeah, that was out in front of the car, right.
Yeah.
So the thing about alcohol is it's 105 octane, and back then gasoline was about 50 octane. So there was a really big difference in the performance on alcohol as there is today.
And they runs cooler too, doesn't it?
That's right. Alcohol, there's a number of reasons, but basically its combustion temperature is down around 1,000 degrees compared to 1,300 degrees for gasoline. So less of alcohol's energy is wasted as heat, and more of it turns into work.
Yeah, you know, my dad worked for Henry Ford Sr.
Mm-hmm.
And Norman Miller was the Henry Ford's personal physician who delivered me at the University of Michigan Hospital.
Huh.
Yeah.
Small world.
Small world. And I got the birth certificate hanging in my office downstairs. Point being that my dad, you know, he's not on this planet anymore. He was an old guy quite a while ago. But he told me that Henry Ford hated petroleum people, and he had 18 acres of hemp plants that he ran, I think, 11 or 12 cars with. He made it right out of hemp. And I guess at the turn of the century, that was a big source of alcohol. I mean, fuel, wasn't it?
Henry Ford did a lot of experimentation with a lot of crops. He had an engineer named Jack Daly. I went back to the Henry Ford Museum and burrowed through their archives.
Cool.
And basically, Ford had people experimenting with all kinds of crops to make alcohol because he was convinced that that was the direction the nation needed to go. He really hated Rockefeller, who was basically his archenemy throughout his whole professional life.
Wow.
And
remember, Henry Ford was a self-made kind of guy, too.
Yes, indeed.
Born with a spoon in his mouth, like Rockefeller.
Well, yeah, and he was a different kind of guy. He understood the ecology of commerce. In other words, Henry Ford used to say, if we can't be the farmer's customer, how can he be ours?
Exactly.
So he understood that, you know, you couldn't just, you know, offshore jobs and then expect the people in this country to keep paying for products, for instance. You know, he understood that relationship between, you know, he basically thought that if his workers couldn't afford to buy a car, then the business model was doomed, and he felt the same way about farmers. So Henry Ford was a huge supporter of what was called the Chemergy movement, where basically the biologists of the day were showing that anything you could make from oil, you could make from plants, people like George Washington Carver, et cetera.
Right. He was quite a biologist. Yeah, I studied him in school.
Yeah. Well, alcohol was the key factor in all of this, you know, because energy is what made everything go. And Rockefeller eventually got tired of Ford and got tired of competing with the farmers, and so he funded the Women's Christian Temperance Movement to the tune of $4 million back in the early 1900s.
That's like $100 million today.
Oh, well, in terms of Congress buying power, it was like $400 million.
Wow.
And, you know, with $400 million, you can buy Congress people.
Yeah, you sure could.
And that's what he did, and he passed Prohibition, which basically was not a law designed to stop drinking. It was a law designed to stop manufacture of alcohol for any reason. So it took alcohol off the market, and Rockefeller cemented his place as the monopoly on our auto fuel for America. But up until then, alcohol and gasoline were neck and neck.
Rudolf Diesel was played into this too somehow, wasn't he? I mean, weren't him and Henry Ford friends?
Well, Diesel actually came a bit later. The diesel engine is a later innovation.
Yeah, okay, keep going. This is fascinating with you. I'm learning a lot today.
Yeah, there's an interesting aspect to the whole diesel thing. You know, when Dr. Diesel first ran his engines, he did it on vegetable oil. And his favorite contender for what ought to be the diesel fuel was palm oil. Now, this is from African nut palms, because much higher yield per acre than other crops. You know, an African nut palms will give you maybe 500 gallons per acre, where soybeans would only give you, you know, 48 gallons per acre. So we went around the world promoting the growing of these nut palms all over the tropics, but it took 10 years for them to get big enough to start producing enough for fuel.
Wasn't that a big industry at one time?
Well, it is today, but what happened was that in that 10 years, Rockefeller figured out how to alter his refining process a little bit and get engines, you know, diesel engines to run on his fuel. So when the palms came on, the market was already taken up, and so all these palm farmers said, well, what are we going to do with the oil? So they started selling it as food. And we ate the stuff for 60 years until about 20 years ago, and doctors looked at it and said, oh, my God, nobody should be eating this stuff. Well, no kidding. It's diesel fuel.
Yeah. Wow. That's really interesting. So whatever happened to Henry Ford, anyway?
Well, he had to give up on alcohol.
Huh?
He had to give up on alcohol during Prohibition.
That's where they got him. So you think that the Prohibition was possibly brought on by the things like he was doing, not the alcohol, the consumption of it.
No, this was all about controlling the market for fuel. This is really well documented.
Oh, I believe it. Mm-hmm. I'm being a political protester myself, I've never really studied this part of the whole, you know, I never even thought of it before as why Prohibition came into.
Let me give you an example.
Yeah.
Toward the end of Prohibition, the Washington Grange, which is like the Farmers Union, sent somebody to Europe to study the German alcohol fuel program. This was actually before Prohibition. And they went over to Germany, which was like not like punching up German alcohol fuel program on Google and figuring out what was going on.
Right.
You actually had to, you know, take a month to get across the country, a month to get across the ocean, you know, and then travel around Germany, a month to drink beer, you know, and then come all the way back. And so the Germans had this incredible system of alcohol fuel production with community distilleries in which farmers brought in potatoes and got back a third of their alcohol, but they also got back the mash, which they used for fertilizer and for animal feed. And the system worked really well. It stopped there being an oversupply of potatoes, which meant farmers didn't go broke in a good year when there were too many, and it provided a real stable source of energy for Germany, which didn't have oil. So they brought back the plans, they were at the meeting in Washington, and Rockefeller had the state police come in and arrest the farmers for having dangerous German ideas, essentially accused them of being terrorists, because it was coming up on World War I. And they were marched off to jail while they sang the national anthem when they were marched out of their hall, and all the plans and stuff were confiscated and destroyed. So the making sure that people couldn't get the information to make their own fuel has been an agenda of the oil companies ever since the early 1900s. And, you know, it's been quite a long, hard road to get our book on alcohol fuel out there. So we've had our share of difficulties with the oil companies over the years.
When did we start losing control of our own supply and having to rely on overseas, you know, Middle Eastern oil? When was that?
Well, that's a fuzzy date. I can give you some benchmarks with that.
You know,
the point at which the United States peaked in oil production and then started downhill. In other words, we never produced more than we, after that point, you know, we started producing less every year, was in 1970.
1970.
That was when we peaked in oil production. And at that point, we were maybe 30% dependent on the Middle East.
That's when it was 50 cents a gallon.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, roughly $2 a barrel back then. And then, of course, at the end of the 70s, we had the OPEC oil embargoes where they shut off the oil to the United States, and 30% of our supply made a big difference. It threw us into economic chaos here. And young people don't believe me when I tell them that just in the 70s, we had to you know, wait in line for fuel. We could only get fuel every other day, and then it was only 10 gallons. And
I remember that very well.
Right. And these young people, they don't understand that that oil tap could get turned off in a moment.
Yep.
And now we're facing the world peak of oil, where the production has leveled off and has started to go downhill worldwide. And now it's time, you know, permanently to change to alternatives. So alcohol is, in my opinion, one of the best, because it's basically liquid solar energy. Plants take carbon dioxide from the air, water, and glue them together with sunlight using photosynthesis, and you get a carbohydrate. Carbo from carbon dioxide, hydrate from water. So those carbohydrates, sugars, etc., we can ferment and make into alcohol using yeast, same process as making wine or beer, and then we distill it to whiskey, basically, but we're looking for at least 190 proof whiskey when we're talking about running cars on it. So, you know, this is a pretty straightforward process. There's not much to ever patent on it ever again, because anything you can think of in terms of making alcohol probably has been thought of. So this is really a people's technology at this point. This isn't going to be wrapped up in somebody's intellectual property and nobody can use it kind of thing. And that's what the oil companies are terrified of, because there's no way to buy off the, you know, scientific development of this so that it can be bottled up anymore. So around the world, whole economies are switching over to alcohol, and the oil companies are basically panicked.
They're what?
Panicked.
Yeah. I can't wait till we do more of them. Now, where do you live? Do you live around here in Southern California? Are you up north? Are you in Canada or England? Where do you live?
I'm in California in Santa Cruz. I'm north of you.
Okay. I wasn't sure where you were living, you know, when I looked up your first try to get a hold of you.
Oh, yes, this internet world. It's hard to tell sometimes.
I know. But what did you think of the of hemp as a source of...
Well, hemp is interesting because it produces a carbohydrate also, which is plant fiber or cellulose. Now, cellulose is being talked about a lot nowadays as a good supply for alcohol, but it is the hardest way to do it because plants make cellulose really, really tough. I mean, the whole point of cellulose is to make a plant strong.
Right.
So breaking all that tens of thousands of sugar molecules that are in a chain of cellulose down into individual sugars, well, that's quite a project. And nature does it with funguses and bacteria and stuff. Powerful, you know, enzymes and chemicals, but it's proven difficult for us to do that economically, even though there are a few methods that actually do work.
So hemp is a worse source than corn, say, example.
Well, it's different because you're talking about cellulose versus
okay.
starch. You know,
okay,
starch is only 35 sugars and easy to dissolve apart with common enzymes that are mass-produced. So if we went to hemp, we'd be looking at probably about 5 tons of cellulose per acre and more alcohol from that than perhaps from corn, maybe 400 or 500 gallons worth per acre, which is a respectable yield. But we'd be doing it the hard way. And the other thing is, you'd never do it economically from hemp because there are so many more valuable things to use hemp for than fuel.
Okay.
Now, the hemp herds or the leftover after making hemp cloth are a waste product that probably, you know, that does not have a lot of other uses, and that could be made into alcohol.
Yeah, I think we used to make sails out of it one time, right? A long time ago, and rope and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Hemp fiber is one of the longest cellulose fibers you can find, so it's really quite valuable. Now, you know, the hemp story, of course, is a rerun of Rockefeller and the alcohol story. In other words, hemp was something that was in the way of synthetic fibers and a lot of other petroleum-based industry. So just like alcohol, they demonized hemp as a drug and then had it prohibited. So prohibition about alcohol was really, you know, the first time they'd done that, and hemp was a rerun of that same corporate strategy. You know, corporations are not very smart, but when they figure out something that works, they try it over and over again. So, you know, when you know the history, then you can see what's coming, and you can be ready to counter it when it comes up.
Yeah, the hemp produces quite a bit of oxygen, too, doesn't it, as a tree, as a plant?
Well, basically all plants do.
Yeah, I know that.
And
yeah.
The bigger a plant gets, you know, the more carbon dioxide it's taken out of the air, and the more oxygen is released back into the air when that carbon is made into, you know, carbohydrates, you know, sugars and starches and cellulose. So hemp's, you know, hemp's got a million uses, but, you know, there's other crops that we can look at for alcohol other than corn that are also, you know, big producers. Like, for instance, cattails. You know, cattails are a marsh plant that everybody's seen in roadside ditches where they...
Oh, I used to pick them when I was a kid. Yeah, I loved them.
Yeah, so they look like a stick with a hot dog on them when they flower. And those plants are actually full of starch. So, again, starch is easier to work with than cellulose, and anybody can turn starch into alcohol, just like turning grain into alcohol. So cattails are really quite powerful weeds. You know, they grow anywhere where there's a little bit of water. And we actually use cattails in California and in other places to treat sewage. In other words, after sewage has mostly been cleaned and broken down,
right,
nutrient water left over, which, you know, is still kind of, you know, not so great to release into rivers or the ocean. If you run it through a cattail marsh first, all those nutrients are absorbed out of the water and become cattails. Well, under those circumstances, we can get 7,500 gallons per acre of alcohol from cattails compared to corn at only 250. So
250 gallons per acre?
Yeah.
Versus 7,500?
Yeah, big difference.
Whoa.
So if every county in the United States processed its sewage through a cattail marsh, we would actually replace all the gasoline and diesel in the United States on less than 2% of the farmland that we currently have. So, you know, one of the things that we can say about sewage is that it's a permanently renewable resource. If we run out of sewage, it means we have other really big problems.
Yeah, well, I don't think we're going to do that for a while.
Yeah, right.
Amazing. So now tell me about your book, and I guess you described how to do this at home, right?
Well, it's on several scales. My book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, shows people how to make alcohol on the individual scale, you know, maybe at 5 gallons an hour, all the way up to the small business scale of 20, 30, 40 gallons an hour. So, you know, this is the scale I think is most practical. A lot of small alcohol plants, maybe up to 1 million gallons per year, or maybe a little bigger in some areas, is probably the better model than the mega 100 million gallon per year plants that are currently being built in the Midwest for corn. And using a wide variety of raw materials is probably the best strategy as well. So we have a diversity of cropping, so we don't have the problems that you have with corn being a monocrop or monoculture, which when you have too much of one crop in one place at one time, well, whatever likes to eat that crop really reproduces out of control. And so now you get into a endless cycle of war with nature to try to control the pests. But, you know, it's really our fault for putting too much of one kind of food in one place at one time.
Right.
So if you have a lot of different crops out there, all of them are good for alcohol, then you basically are, you know, doing some of the basic work of organic farming, which is crop rotation and mixed cropping and that kind of thing. So in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, we talk about different ways to go about polyculture or making sure that we're doing things ecologically when we grow for food and fuel.
So if I got some, you know, land and that I live on, and how hard is it for me to set up to make some fuel? And how, like, if I have a BMW X5, could I change the chip or adjust the chip on it? So, like, instead of having to switch to Henry Ford head, how would I go about, running that along with gasoline? Just mix a certain amount of it equal or something, or what?
There's a lot of things we can do. First of all, what year was your car again?
Well, I got a 2001 BMW X5 as an example. I got other cars, but that's one that I would...
Yeah, and that one needs premium, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right, because it's a high-compression engine.
Right.
So alcohol is 105 octane, so it's better than the best premium you can buy.
Yeah.
So what you can do with that car is you can mix half regular gas and half alcohol and have still way more octane than you need. So now it's really cheap. And your car has automatic, most cars of this vintage, you know, the newer cars, have automatic timing control. So they don't need to have the little lever on the side of the column
where
you would change the tuning or timing. Cars do that automatically nowadays. So your car would automatically advance more for alcohol. Now, because fuel injection is smart and flexible, you know, the fuel injection sniffs your exhaust and then adjusts the amount of fuel you need.
Right.
most fuel injection systems are smart enough where you can go all the way up to 50% alcohol without making any changes whatsoever.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, and almost nobody knows this. Everyone will tell you, oh, no, you can't go putting that alcohol stuff in your car unless it's specially set up for it or you've made a conversion to do it. Now, that might be true if you're trying to run pure alcohol or 85% alcohol the way they sell it at 2,000 pumps around the country.
Yeah.
But you can run 50% without any changes at all. So you don't have to do anything to start being part of the alcohol revolution. The trouble is, once you've replaced half of your petroleum with alcohol and you're feeling really good about that, that other half is going to really bug you. You know,
yeah, it does anyway.
Buy it from the oil companies.
Yeah.
So, you know, converting to run on straight alcohol is actually, I go through this in detail in the book. There's a lot of off-the-shelf parts you can use that generally cost only maybe $50 to $150 that you can change your car over so that it'll run on straight alcohol. Or E85, which is 85% alcohol, which is the way it's sold around the U.S. Now, there are also kits.
Yeah, wait a minute. So not right now. A lot of gas has 15%. Ethanol in it anyway.
Well, in California, it's 5.7%. That's all we have so far, but it's probably going to go to 10% in the next year or two.
What would happen there? I thought California was the ecological leader. I mean, they sure are in smogging.
Well, you know, California is the biggest gasoline market in the world, and the oil companies make sure they keep control of it. So our California Air Resources Board is pretty much completely captured by the oil companies. And they've been holding off alcohol for the last few years with one excuse after the other.
Yeah, and I've noticed there have been a lot of excuses. I didn't know why.
Well, it's because everybody, I mean, we had a whole run of Republican governors forever who appointed everybody who was in charge of that agency. So, you know, the whole agency is, you know, it's like the chickens being guarded by the fox, you know. So, you know, it's one of those situations. So in California, you know, there are a few stations going in. But it's interesting, the guy putting in the stations is a oil company hitman, and he's taking the grant money from the state, putting in the stations in gas stations, and then he plans to package the whole thing up and sell the whole thing to the oil companies once the grant requirements are met. So, you know, even the grants to put in stations, the oil companies have put their guy in to make sure that the program doesn't go anywhere. So we're putting in the first independent alcohol station in Santa Cruz, where we're going to sell E98 at the pump, or 98% pure alcohol.
Really?
And we're in the permit process for that now. We ought to have that up and running in the next few months.
And how much is a gallon going to cost?
Well, it really depends. Wholesale alcohol right now is about $2.20 a gallon, where wholesale gasoline is about $3.25.
Yeah.
Now, that's where we'll start, but you can make alcohol for a lot less. Like, if you're going to make it yourself, you can make alcohol for, gosh, 50 cents, a dollar a gallon.
Wow.
Because there's all these great waste materials around that you can make alcohol from in California. We're a big agricultural and food processing state. So, you know, for instance, somewhere around the corner from where you live, there's going to be a donut shop. And, you know, there's a funny thing about donuts. Cops can only eat so many, and then they got to throw the rest away.
Right.
So a pickup truck full of donuts will make you 100 gallons of alcohol.
Wow.
And that'll only cost you about 30 cents a gallon.
Only 30 cents.
Yeah, because you're not paying anything for the raw material, just the cost of picking it up.
Wow.
So if you have to grow a crop, you can make alcohol for about $1.20, $1.30 a gallon or so. You know, and then what they sell it for is not really, you know, like marking it up 20% or something. They're selling it for as much as they can get away with, you know, because the oil companies buy most of the alcohol to add to gasoline. But the cost of making alcohol is not all that steep. Except when you make it from corn, because the price of corn is up right now.
Yeah. What are you recommending in your book, or to if you don't have enough donut shops around? What would be a practical vegetable? You'd have to go out and make a deal with a farmer, I guess, to get a bunch of corn.
Well, for instance, down where you live, you know where you live, Fred, is for instance, all kinds of citrus growing.
And yeah,
enormous amounts of waste.
On our
citrus.
Other property, we got avocado trees. I don't know if you can use those or not, but
avocados, man! I'd be eating them long before I get around to making them into anything.
Yeah, well, but, there's 320 trees.
Oh my!
Yeah.
Well, if you sprout the avocados, the fat in the avocados will be turned into sugar, and then you could ferment them.
Yeah,
that's a kind of complicated thing to do.
But what would be a more practical Southern California?
Well, you know, waste oranges. There's, you know, millions and millions of tons of waste oranges and what they call citrus molasses, which is byproducts from the orange juice business, et cetera, that are available that are, you know, very inexpensive waste product. Any bakery has, you know, waste bread, for instance. All the tortilla places have waste tortillas. It goes on and on if you start looking at places that make candy or soda pop, and there's all these different waste products. We cover
all
this.
If you're using oranges or orange paste or whatever,
yeah,
make 100 gallons, how many pounds of orange, oranges or orange, you know, byproduct would you need to make 100 gallons?
Well, it would all depend on how much water is still in it. If you were looking at raw oranges,
yeah,
because there's so
orange.
Much water in oranges,
yeah, so
you'd only get 20 gallons out of a pickup truck because almost all of it's water.
Yeah, okay, I got it.
Where in the case of donuts, it's almost no water and it's almost all starch.
Yeah.
You know, from the, you know. So anyway, the book has charts that show you how much per gallon and how much per ton, so you can figure out what kind of things work for you. And then you get out in the valley and there's all kinds of fruit and stuff that's processed on a, you know, seasonal basis. So it really depends on where you are.
Well, then, so you take your substance, let's just say for example, it's donuts, what do you do with it next?
Well, you cook it up in water and you add enzymes which break the starch down into sugar. And then, you know, one of the things about donuts is they're cooked in fat. So we skim the fat off the top and then we use that in a fuel oil burner to fire the still as our energy source.
Oh, there you go. That's,
so there's a raw material that comes with its own energy source, you know. But if you were living further out, away from the coast, and you were talking about, like, you know, back in the more arid areas to the eastern part of California, you could grow mesquite, for instance, which is a nitrogen-fixing tree that loves living in deserts.
Yeah.
Doesn't need fertilizer, doesn't need water. You know, it just grows great. Prickly pear cactus, which is all over Southern California, can grow underneath the mesquite. And then underneath that, there's a weed that grows out there called buffalo gourd, which lots of people have seen who live out in the desert. And it's a squash-looking plant that has giant, honking, starchy roots that can be harvested to make alcohol. So here you could be out in the desert, not even on farmland, with almost no irrigation water, and you can get 600, 700, 800 gallons per acre by growing a polyculture. In other words, multiple crops that complement each other together to make alcohol.
Wow. Now, like with a mesquite plant, that's a pretty dry plant anyway.
Oh, yeah.
So you just grab the whole, it's kind of prickly.
No, the pods.
You just chop it up and grind it up like in a shredder, like if you're trimming your tree and you got a shredder, what do you do?
Well, that'll do it. You know, and the pods are about 35% sugar.
Wow.
So they're very easy to ferment. You don't have to kill the tree. You know, you're not harvesting the tree. You're just harvesting the pods. And the byproduct is really good. You know, byproduct for either animal feed or growing mushrooms on, or, you know, we go over in the book all these different great byproducts you can make from the leftovers from the alcohol process that are actually worth more than the alcohol. I mean, growing oyster mushrooms on the byproduct from, you know, for instance, orange peel, you know, you can use the byproduct after you're done making the alcohol to raise oyster mushrooms, which are worth $7 or $8, $9 a pound.
Where do you find those? On the actual plant or what?
Oh, no, you cultivate those.
Oh.
You know, in other words, you'd use the waste pulp left over, and you'd use that as a raw material to grow mushrooms on. And then you could take the byproduct from growing the mushrooms that, you know, used to be the orange peels, and now you can feed that to tilapia, which are a really good eating fish. And then you can take the fish water from after the fish poop out into the water and all those nutrients are there, you can use those to grow organic vegetables in greenhouses or even strawberry plants with drip irrigation. So, you know, if you look at the ecological design of a small alcohol plant, it's really a food and fuel center. You know, it's not just making alcohol.
Yeah, you've got a whole self-contained process you've just described, pretty much.
Right, and there are many variations. We go over a lot of these in my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas.
Yeah, let people know, where all does that, can that book be purchased?
Well, you can order it at any bookstore, or, you know, but if you order it from us, I send you an autographed copy with a free $25 DVD. So my website is pretty simple. It's alcoholcanbeagas.com.
Yeah, That's pretty easy to remember.
And for those of you who don't use computers, you can always order it directly from us at toll-free 888-PERMACULTURE, which is 737-6228.
Yeah, I can't wait to get me a book. I need to get one.
Well, I think you do,
one.
Fred.
Yeah. Because I've always wanted to know the food chain cycle to make ethanol, and it sounds like you've described many.
Yes, there's a lot of variations depending on what raw materials you have at hand.
So where do you get a, like, take the old barrels to boil this stuff in, or is there places around that sell big pots? I mean, you need like a 200-gallon or at least a 100-gallon barrel, I would think, to do the boiling and get the fermentation process going, right?
The book shows you how to make stills that go anywhere from 2 gallons per hour up to about 20 gallons per hour.
Oh, okay.
So a tank about the size of your car would be able to make 100 to 200 gallons of alcohol in a day.
Wow.
So that's enough for you for the whole month, usually. So.
Oh, yeah. I don't drive a lot, so it would be easily 100 gallons to run two or three cars around here for a month.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people in Southern California that have to commute, and so
yeah.
100 gallons, that's just beginning to get it, you know.
So where do you guys, when you start, where's your gas station going to be, in Santa Cruz?
That's where, yes, we're going to be putting it in Santa Cruz, once we get through the permit process.
Are you having much problems getting your permits?
Well, not any more than any other business. Nothing too complicated. You know, a long time ago, the oil companies made it pretty easy to get permits for gas stations, you know, so we're getting to go in under their radar.
Oh, that's pretty good. So I know when there's been a gas station and you it's no longer there, and then you want a contractor comes in and wants to build a house there, they got a big EPA cleanup thing they have to go through, even if there's nothing there.
I'd avoid those sites like the plague.
Yeah, yeah.
Gasoline is incredibly toxic, and almost all these stations are leakers, because of the way they built them. So nowadays, what we suggest for alcohol fuel stations, and we're really a fan of the idea of driver-owned alcohol fuel stations, where people get together and chip in and build their own station on some, you know, strip malls, you know, non-revenue producing asphalt, where you just set the thing on the ground, you know, plug it in and start selling fuel. You know, it's basically a tank and a pump and a card reader, and you're off and running. So, you can, for a few hundred dollars a piece, a group of people in a neighborhood can get together and build something like this. You know, it would take part of a neighborhood to pull it off. So that's something we talk about in the book, is how to do community-supported energy where people have driver-owned stations. And one of the cool reasons to do that is that as owners of the station, as being in a business, you get the same tax credits that oil companies get. They buy alcohol now, and they blend it with gasoline, and they get tax credit for every gallon they buy.
That's why they make billions of dollars a year.
Well, there's a lot of reasons why they make billions of dollars a year, mostly because they're out there screwing us. But,
yeah, exactly.
You know, and not paying their bills when it comes to environmental cleanup, and they get $5.60 worth of various incentives and credits for every gallon. We in the alcohol world only get 61 cents, but think about it for a minute, Fred. If you go out and make yourself alcohol from, let's say, you know, the waste candy from a local candy manufacturing place, and you make it for, you know, a buck a gallon or something, just let's just say that rash round number. Well, if you get a 61 cent tax credit, you take that off the $1, you're down to 40 cents now.
Yeah.
Now, the cool thing about this tax credit is that the oil companies are the ones who mostly collect it. So they went to the IRS and said, hey, we don't want no stinking tax credit. We're the oil companies. We don't pay any taxes.
Exactly. I know they weren't, yeah.
So we want cash, and so that's the way the law is written. So you turn your paperwork in, and 90 days later, you get a check from the IRS. Now, I got to tell you, Fred, there aren't many better days on this planet than when you fill up your own car with the alcohol you've made, and you screw the oil companies and the IRS.
That's way cool. Just by working through the loopholes, you explain all this in your book?
All this is in our book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas.
Did you publish your book yourself or not?
Yeah, we did. We decided to self-publish it because we really didn't want to have problems with publishers telling us what we could say and not say. And quite frankly, this is the second time this book has been written. I first wrote an earlier version of this book in the 80s. to go along with a 10-part series I did on PBS.
Right.
And when the series went on the air, and I was at the printer with the book, it was a partnership with PBS, the San Francisco station.
Right.
The oil companies called up and said, "We don't get it. We thought you liked our money. Why do you have this thing on the air?" And so, you know, they literally called up and said, "Stop the presses," when I was at the print shop in Oregon. And they canceled the printing of the book. They canceled the release of the series to 140 PBS stations.
Really? And, they kicked you off PBS?
What's that?
Wow.
That was in 1983. So we didn't want to risk that this time. So, for instance, in Southern California, one foundation, the Big Cats Foundation, lent us some money, and so did about 40 other people. And so the whole thing has been privately financed, so we have taken no money from the alcohol industry, and we haven't taken money from any corporations really at all. So we were able to be completely independent in how we approached the book and didn't have to bow to anybody's interests.
Yeah, are you still, how long has this newest book been out anyway?
Oh, it's just been out a few months, but only now are people like you, Fred, having the guts to have us on the air. I mean, we were completely shut out for the first 6 months that the book was you know, out, that nobody in the press would talk to us. They didn't want to risk their oil company ads, and, you know, it's been really tough until recently.
Yeah, because this, you should, are you guys going to put some infomercials together?
Well, yeah, you know, it'd be great if we could have a couple of donors step forward and say, you know, you guys really need to get the word out and help fund us to do some of those things.
Yeah, we should. You should run a... I'll get Don. I'm one of the owners of BBS. We'll make you some kind of special deal to run an ad on the front on our website. You know, because we get millions of hits per month.
Wow!
At BBS Radio, we're probably
cool.
The largest, you know, BBA computer starting going. You know, we have above the ground stations and all that to pick us up, but we're not syndicated with any chain yet. But we have seemed to be very successful, and we'd probably be a good place to advertise that book.
Well, yeah, any help we can get in getting the word out would be really welcome.
Yeah, because we've had it up on the, for the last week. We've had it on the index page, and I imagine that several million people have seen it.
Wow, well, that's great.
Yeah.
So let me tell you a story about this. I went on another radio show recently called Coast to Coast. Which
yeah,
is
I know. I've been
show.
On that with Art Bell and George Norrie and everybody. Ian Punnett.
Yeah, so George had us on.
Yeah.
And 6 million people were listening to the show. You know, it's our first, you know, really good-sized show.
Yeah, that's a good show.
And, you know, so many people were listening to that show that when I told people what I told you earlier, that, look, folks, you can start using alcohol today and go on our site. You know, alcohol can be a guess.
Yeah.
Go to the station locator, find a place, and tomorrow buy yourself some alcohol and stop giving your money to the oil companies.
Right.
So people started doing it, and the oil companies noticed the dip in income.
Oh, yeah.
And
they noticed it off the
out
radio, yeah.
Because George Norrie's show went out to like 6 million people, and a lot of people went and did this the next day. And so they sent out a letter a couple of weeks ago to all the gas station owners that have alcohol at the pump saying, don't let anybody put that in their car unless they have an official flexible fuel vehicle. You might be liable for yada, 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 yada. And we're making gas station employees, I mean, minimum wage guys, sign declarations saying that they would stop people from putting alcohol in their cars. We actually got a pretty good level of panic out of Mega Oil Run.
Good.
You know, so radio is powerful, you know, and people taking action is what counts.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we've given too much money away to other nations. I mean, way too much. We're to the point we're bankrupting this country with the money here. We just print it and then give it away. And they know that. I mean, you know, it's amazing how we lost the value of the dollar in the last 12, 15 months. Scary.
Oh, yeah. Now, let's look at Brazil. Now, here's a country that...
Oh, that's an interesting deal.
Yeah. Brazil is, you know, not exactly a small little country, right?
No.
They're the fifth biggest country in the world, and they, get this, they import exactly not one, zero, nada barrels of oil a year.
Wow.
So they are completely petroleum independent
wow.
You know, of the world market. They have some of their own oil for, you know, things that they need oil for, like plastics and this and that.
Right.
But they don't need the gasoline, which is the toxic waste byproduct of the refining business. It's what's left over after they make all these other products. So here in the United States, we pay for the privilege of taking the oil company's toxic waste and burning it for them in our cars.
Right.
In Brazil, there's nowhere to get rid of it because nobody wants to buy it. You know, 80% of the cars in Brazil run on alcohol.
Right.
So they have to sell it on the world market to get rid of it because no one there wants it.
Interesting.
So if all these countries started going to alcohol...
Well, Brazil's got a lot of jungle around it. I mean, they shouldn't have any problem getting a source. What do they make their alcohol out of anyway?
Well, they use sugarcane in Brazil, and not on jungle land, but on the dry plains of what's called the Cerrado ecosystem. So the rainforest is over 1,000 miles away in Brazil, and none of the rainforest is anywhere near where the alcohol sugarcane is being produced.
Interesting. Like Hawaii on Oahu, they used to do a lot of sugar. They do a lot of sugarcane there.
That's right.
That would be, and I heard that Hawaiian gas is going for more than European gas now.
Well, it might be. I was there not too long ago, and it was over $5. So, you know, it was even more expensive than California.
Yeah, that's what I heard too.
Now the rest of the world's paying more. Now I talked to farmers in Western Australia.
Yeah,
they're paying $10 a gallon. I talked to, you know, people in South Africa, they're paying $12. I talked to people in Ghana, they're paying $14 a gallon.
Wow.
So the rest of the world is already, you know, starting to pay the full price of gasoline, and we got an election coming up, so, you know, the oil companies are keeping, you know, keeping their heads down and making everything look good until November 8th. And believe me, mark my words, beginning on November 8th, the price of gas starts going back up again, and we'll be over $4 within 2 months.
Oh, I believe it. You know, what I've noticed is every year, you know, they raise it way high in the spring, they drop it in the fall, but they never drop it to a level that they've started it from. They always notch it up about 20%.
Well, that's what's been going on ever since we've had this current administration. I mean,
yeah.
When George Bush took office, gasoline was about $1.40 a gallon.
I hear they're hauling quite a bit of gas out of Iraq and bringing it back and sticking it back in the ground in Texas.
Well, gosh, I don't know anything about that. I know they have a hard time getting any oil out of Iraq because we don't hear about a lot of it in the press, but there's thousands and thousands of miles of pipeline that, you know, anybody and his brother can go ahead and shoot a hole in with a rifle or blow up, you know. There's over 100,000 miles of exposed pipeline in the world. So, you know, it's a good target if you're really ticked off at whatever government happens to be around. I have a great story for you from Bolivia, where the region in Bolivia where they're pumping the oil out of is really poor, and it goes down to the port cities where, you know, all the petrol elites make all their money. So the mayors way out there in the rural areas were saying, hey, you guys, you got to start sending some money back our way because, you know, it's fouling our environment and you're extracting it from our states and, you know, it's only fair that you share the profits with us. And, of course, they were ignored, you know, because they were, you know, campesinos living out there in the back of Bolivia. Well, the mayor of the town just got a box of dynamite and went down there with a few other farmers and they blew up the pumping station.
Whoa.
Well, you know, took out about 20% of the deliverable capacity of Bolivia, and they got attention. And so, you know, there was a little reform. They're getting a share of the profit now. I mean, this guy's hardly a terrorist. He's just basically a hometown hero, you know, trying to take care of his town. And, like, you know, he just went and took out the pumping station. You know?
I love it. That was
but it points out how vulnerable the oil system is, you know, when you have centralized energy. If you have millions of stills all over the country...
Hold on, I think we might have a caller. Is there a caller on the line?
Let's do it.
Yeah, good evening, guys. This is
Hi.
Jim from Florida.
Hi.
Hi, I just had a comment on the price of oil. I heard Lindsay Williams, he's got a movie on Google Video you can watch for free called The Non-Energy Crisis.
Hmm.
He's got some high-level connections with some oil execs, and they told him oil's going to back to $50 a barrel, then it's going to shoot back up again. So that may tie in with the time of the elections, but he predicted that conflict in Russia and the top at 148, and we've had hurricanes in the Gulf last week, and it's still selling off and breaking crucial support levels. So that'd be a hell of a trade if you could ride that down and get it back up again. That would pay for a few tankfuls of gas. And is ethanol good or bad for the car? I'm not a fan of ethanol because it burns at half the heat and decreases your gas mileage.
Well, let's take care of some of these myths, okay? So, first of all, ethanol is good for your car. Basically, alcohol is 98% pollution-free. So you're saying, wait a minute, how is being pollution-free good for your car? It's obviously good for the air. What it means is no carbon in your engine whatsoever. So your oil never turns black, and carbon in your engine is what is like microscopic sandpaper, which wears down your rings and your cylinder walls and ruins your engine over time. So with alcohol, I've torn down engines on 500,000 miles, and looked inside the cylinders, and 60% of the machine marks are still there on the inside of the cylinder walls after 500,000 miles. So you could throw that engine back together and run it for another 500,000 miles before you'd have to rebuild it. And we've got a lot of good 20-year documentation now in side-by-side fleets in Brazil where gasoline engines have been rebuilt twice in the last 20 years, and the alcohol ones are still waiting for their first rebuild. So alcohol is really good for your car. Now, this half the heat, mileage stuff, that really turns out to be a good piece of propaganda. The argument usually is because the BTUs, or heat energy per pound of fuel, is lower in alcohol than it is in gasoline. It's about 29% less. So the pundits say, oh, well, that means you'll get 29% miles per gallon. But the assumption in there is that both of the fuels burn with the same efficiency in your engine. In other words, the percentage of energy turned into work is the same in both. Well, measuring a fuel's BTU per pound doesn't give you any real indication of what the mileage will be. It only tells you what is the amount of heat you'll get if you burn the fuel completely in an open flame. When you're trying to talk about how fuels work in engines, it's a whole different set of things. What we really are looking at is the joules, or the work provided by the fuel. Alcohol is up to 43% efficient. Gasoline hovers around 20%. So alcohol, although it starts off with less energy, can actually, under the right conditions, in a diesel-like engine, have 22% better mileage than diesel. And that's much higher than gasoline. Now, if you just convert your gasoline car over to alcohol using a kit from us or using the different strategies in the book about using aftermarket parts, you're probably going to lose a little mileage. But it's not 29%. It's more like 5 to 10%. But, of course, if you're making fuel for $1 a gallon, who cares?
Yeah, that's pretty interesting. You've done your homework on this.
Oh, well, I've been doing this for 25 years.
Yeah, and I noticed you got the physics of it down, too, which is really cool.
Well, you know, physics is, you know, it's a really great thing to know physics because it tells you how things work.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, when you know how things work, it's pretty hard for people to pull the wool over your eyes.
Yeah. So when you start talking in ergs and joules, and I know you're you're right. You know exactly what you're talking about. I was a physicist for a long time before I went to NASA, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really cool. Yeah, as a matter of fact, I think we probably want to get a bunch of books and start selling them on our website over at Paradigm. I think we can. And you guys, did I hear you say you have the kits and stuff to convert your motor over and stuff too?
Yeah, actually, we are working with a company in Santa Monica that is making a really good conversion kit. There are several on the market that are not very good that come from Brazil.
Right.
They're good for Brazilian conditions, but we have a little different setup here. So the kits are generally about $400, depending on how many cylinders you have in your car. And
right.
When you plug this thing into your car, it basically is an additional computer, so your car is a lot smarter and is able to handle a wider range of air-fuel mixtures, which is what's necessary for alcohol, going back to almost being the Model T again, except for the computer this time. And, means you don't have to think about whatever you put in the tank. You can put in alcohol, you can put in gasoline, any mixture, and the computer's smart enough to adjust appropriately. There are a number of stations going in Southern California over the next year, so you will be able to get alcohol. You'll just have to go on our website and look up what stations are open as they open, and so you'll know what ones you're close to. So there should be, I believe, 15 or so stations opening up in the L.A. to San Diego corridor.
Yeah, you, too bad you guys just get a chain of them that's your group. You know, you should build more than one.
Well, you know, it's interesting. People have been asking us to do that, and we're willing to do it. We're getting to a place where if people want to help back that effort, we would very much like to put in a chain of stations. One of the reasons why it's a good investment is that the federal government gives you a 30% tax credit on putting in a station. So let's say a station costs $200,000 to put in. You know, basically there's a tax credit of about $60,000-something for putting that in.
Wow.
So that's a pretty nice instant return on your investment, is to be able to walk away from $60,000 worth of taxes.
Yeah,
so,
I'll bet with alcohol use, a lot of people have older cars and they barely pass smog, and they have to spend a whole lot of money. I guess if they put alcohol in them, they could pass smog right away, couldn't they?
Well, let me tell you, I always, you know, of course, that's one of the banes of living in California. You have to go get your car smogged every 2 years.
Right.
But I make it into theater every time. So I go on down to a different smog place every year, and they go, I don't say a word, and they put in the probe up the exhaust pipe, and they spin it up on the dynamometer, and, you know, the guy's looking at the gauges, and he's looking at the gauges, and he starts hammering on top of the machine. He starts hammering on the side of the machine because the gauges don't move.
Yeah, no
alcohol
smog at all.
98% pollution free.
Yeah, no,
so
hydrocarbons.
So usually before he does any serious damage, I'll let him know that you're not going to get any readings. Sorry, guy, it's running on alcohol, you know.
What do they say?
Oh, they just freak out, you know, because they're used to seeing all these really dirty vehicles, you know. Even the ones that are legal are still putting out all kinds of pollution.
Oh, yeah.
But on alcohol, basically, it's either unmeasurable or almost unmeasurable. Like, you know, if you really push it on my truck, you'll get 4 parts per million NOx, you know, nitrous oxide. And
yeah,
my truck's allowed to have 400.
I know.
So I'm at, you know, 1% of the... And the carbon monoxide and the nitrous, carbon monoxide and the hydrocarbons are zero, can't be measured. So, you know, I'm down at 1% of one of the pollutants and 0% on the others. And that's no big deal. That's easy to do on alcohol.
So they just give you a printout and that's the end of it, huh?
Oh, that's the end of it, yeah.
That's funny. Yeah, that is really cool.
So if you're having trouble passing smog, well, you need to start running alcohol and you will pass smog.
Yeah. That's really interesting. You know, we run out of time, Dan. I'm going to call you probably next week if I get a chance and talk to you about some distribution and that down here, you know?
Well, great. We'll do that. And people ought to remember to take a look at our website, which is alcoholcanbeagas.com. Or if you're not a computer person, well, give us a ring at 888-737-6228, and you can order the book directly.
Yeah. I think it's really important to get this book out there, and I'm real interested in your system, too.
Good.
Conversion and all that, you know.
Well, thanks a lot, Fred.
Well, boy, it's really a pleasure having you on tonight. You're totally, it's nice to have somebody that really goes above and beyond the call of duty to really be informed about every aspect of what you do.
We got a planet to save, and it's everybody's job to do their part, so I'm just doing mine.
Yeah, you're doing more than yours. Anyhow, you've been listening to Dr. Fred Bell's Health, Science, and Energy Show. Our guest tonight has been David Bloom. Check the front page of BBS Radio for his website, we'll keep that posted. We'll have his books available here at Paradigm, and you can buy them pretty much from any bookstore. So until next weekend, we'll see you then. Thanks a lot.